Hello. In recent audio clips, we've been talking about the evil of federalism and the Senate and why we need to remove it completely from the American political system. And we had shared that our intention was to not only say how bad federalism and the Senate are, but to offer the solution, the alternative. So the question is, what if we take out federalism and the Senate, what should we put in instead? And we were about to share the details of that when I came into the realization that if I just went ahead and explained what the alternative is, and if that alternative was interpreted in terms of the current political legislative system, that the solution, the alternative, would seem worse than the original problem. So that's why it's important that we first talk about how the legislative process has to be redone from the inside out. And then the alternative to federalism will become much easier to understand and to see how it actually will work. So that's the intention that we have in this audio clip, to start talking about how to redo the legislative process under a new constitutional system. But before going into that, I just wanted to quickly talk about another news story that came out around the time of this recording, and had to do with what I call the Attorney General that was appointed by this fraudulent administration. He came out on the news saying that he was going to threaten, he was threatening the current audits being done in Arizona and potentially other states. And he was going to be scrutinizing them to see if they had committed some sort of voter law violation, which is kind of ironic. You know, that's like the pottle calling the kettle African American. It's totally ridiculous that they would now try to stand on high ground pretending to be the righteous ones. But the reason why this drew my attention is that when I went to the comment section of the web page that showed this story, people were outraged naturally, but they started talking about how the Constitution does not allow this individual to do this because the Constitution clearly has given the state the authorities to run the elections their way, and they were kind of shouting it from the rooftops as if to say the Constitution is protecting us from this evil Attorney General who is trying to meddle with the audit process that's going on in Arizona at the time of this recording. And when I began to read those comments, my heart just sank even further, because I became more and more aware of how difficult it is for these people to understand that their Constitution and that their conservatism is leading to the problem. And when they see that conservatism in their constitution somehow lessening the depth of the problem just by a little bit, they see it as a validation of the whole system. So they still don't understand that it was because of federalism that the Democrats were able to manipulate elections within each state outside of the view of the nation. Even though it was a centralized national effort, they were able to do it locally under the umbrella and the protection of local state laws and systems and people, so that now if we want to contest the election, we have to contest it in each individual state separately, because each one is a separate system of its own. So conservatives still don't understand that federalism is what got us into this problem. And aside from that, conservatives seem to miss the bigger point, that in a certain sense, you could say that when this Attorney General came out and made this threat that they were going to go after the people doing these audits, he was basically doing what I'd call a dog whistle to blue states. In other words, to states run by Democrats here in America, as if to say, hey, guys, I need your help. Please put things in your state laws that will make audits like the one happening in Arizona illegal in the future? And also, could you guys make it easier for me in the future that could you put something in your state laws that if they ever try an audit like that again, that I, from the federal level, would have the power to go in and punish these people for daring to question our fraudulent elections? And if the states go, you know, are paying attention and listen to this dog whistle, and especially in the states that are controlled by Democrats, that is going to be very, very easy for them to make audits like this in the future virtually impossible to execute, and there'll be nothing in the Constitution protecting us from such changes in state law. So this is the real message behind what this Attorney General was doing this week with his threats. He was actually inadvertently reaffirming that federalism is the answer to continue executing voter fraud in the future, because all they have to do is adjust and tweak local state laws to make audits like this, like the one happening in Arizona, virtually impossible to carry out without some sort of legal punishment, not only from the state level, but from the federal level, if the state laws write that into their punishment list. So now, again, even though it seems like federalism is protecting us from the Attorney General, first of all, the Attorney General is probably not going to be able to do much because there really is, he doesn't really have much weaponry to work with to begin with. So this is just an empty threat. But conservatives don't realize that there's a bigger message behind this threat that makes it even more evident that the current Constitution that conservatives love so much is a disaster, along with its federalism. So now that we've gotten that out of the way, let's think about the legislative process that we would need to have under a new system so that then we can get rid of federalism in the Senate and be successful in doing so. So the question becomes, how does that process look like? We'd have obviously this process in a single house system, a unicameral system. So we've gotten rid of the Senate in our minds. So we're left with just one house. And so that would be, you know, what we currently call the House of Representatives. But just to kind of change things a little bit so that we know that we're talking about a different entity. Instead of calling it the House of Representatives, let's call it the House of Commons, the way it's called in Britain. And the reason for calling it like that is not just to imitate the name in Britain. As you will hopefully see later on, there is a reason that I have, a very strong reason why, to me, it's symbolically very important to call it the House of Commons. It's kind of to emphasize a certain point that I hope will become clear later on. So from now on, we'll be referring to this new House of Representatives in this unicameral legislative system as the American House of Commons. So this house would have a representation that's proportional to the population, the way the current House of Representatives is. But there's going to be an important difference to how House members are voted in, and we'll talk about that later. And that has to do with another big problem we've had in the American system with gerrymandering. But that'll be for a future audio clip, I'm pretty sure. So let's just for now say it's going to be a place where the states with greater population will have a greater number of representatives, and the states that have fewer people will have fewer representatives. It will be proportional to the population of each state, the way it is right now with the current House. So we'll have that system. Now, in the current House of Representatives, there is a person that's called the Speaker of the House that most of you may be aware of. And that person came into being because the Founding Fathers wrote that person in Article 1, Section 2. At the end of that section, there's a short paragraph that says, "The House of Representatives shall choose their Speaker and their officers, and shall have sole power of impeachment." So it says there that there's going to be a speaker that the House of Representatives will choose. So they kind of gave birth to the position right there. And then on top of that, in Article 1, Section 5, we've mentioned this before as well, but in the second paragraph of that section, it says, each House may determine the rules of its proceedings, punish its members for disorderly behavior, and with the concurrence of two-thirds, expel a member. So the Founding Fathers basically said, the House can make up its own rules. You know, they can decide how it's going to be run. And it's clear to me in my head that they didn't really give much thought to what they were writing. They were just kind of delegating the problem, or kind of pushing the problem down the road. Like, oh, we're not gonna worry about how to make these rules. That's too complicated for us. So let somebody else decide it for us. And they didn't think that if you have a house that is run by a certain party, controlled by a certain party, that if the party and the house can decide its own rules, then the controlling party will change its rules to favor its agenda. So they just gave this carte blanche to the house to say, you do whatever you want, you make up your own rules. And it will be constitutional because the Constitution says you can make up whatever rules you want. So so we have the Speaker of the House, and we have a House where the rules are decided by the House itself. Now, where did this concept of Speaker of the House come from? As many of you, I think, may know, this was not an original idea. Most of the things in the Constitution were not original. As brilliant as the conservatives always make the Founding Fathers out to be, not many of these ideas were very original to begin with. The Speaker of the House, that concept came from Britain. As some of you may know, Britain has had a Speaker of the House of Commons since around the 13th century. The position is almost as old as Parliament itself. And so there is a British version of the Speaker of the House, and they have had it for eight centuries already. So that's where the Founding Fathers got the idea. And as you may know, the current Speaker is Lindsay Hoyle at the time of this recording. And one thing that the Speaker in Britain has that is different from the American version is that the British Speaker has to sever his ties, all ties to his political party when he becomes the Speaker of the House. He does not vote on any motion except when it comes to doing doing tie breaking. So unless there's a need to break a tie, the Speaker of the House kind of abstains. So he renounces affiliation to his party. He does not vote like the rest of the MPs. And you would say, well, does that mean that the party that he belongs to loses a vote? Well, the answer is no, because they have in the British system a way for that to be evened out. The Speaker does not vote, and the number one MP after him that belongs to his party does not vote either. And then the top two MPs from the opposite party don't vote either. So that means that each party, in effect, loses two votes. So that kind of evens out the field. I'm not sure if this is kind of if it's official or if it's something that's done out of courtesy. But regardless of whether it's official or something done out of tradition and courtesy, the Speaker of the House not being able to vote does not lessen the voting majority of the party he or she belongs to. So he is apolitical, and he's there to maintain discipline and order during debates. So he can tell someone, an MP, to shut up during a debate, and if he's out of order and he doesn't listen, he can kick the MP out of the debate for the rest of the day. So he's basically like a football referee. So if the MP is misbehaving, he can, you know, caution him with a yellow card. And if the MP keeps causing trouble, then he can take out the red card and expel the MP for the rest of the game. So as you can see, the British version is much more of a referee than the American version. He tries to be neutral and is there more or less to just coordinate things and allow the debate to flow and keep things moving. That's his role. As you can see, there's no focus on power. There's nothing about the position, the way it's defined, the way it is traditionally executed, that causes the speaker to feel like he's more powerful than the rest of the MPs, and that therefore the MPs owe something to him that they must, you know, somehow ingratiate themselves with him so that their bills can be passed, or so that certain special interests can have what they want. He's just a referee there, making sure that everything is running smoothly. So that's how the British version went. But unfortunately, the American version kind of took a different turn. At the beginning, the Speaker of the House didn't really have much power. Especially, you know, the nation was getting started, and people really didn't know how to work out that position. And then along came Henry Clay in the 1810s and the 1820s. I think he was Speaker of the House like multiple times during those two decades. And because he was a very apparently from what I can gather a very charismatic man, an intelligent man. He began to create much power around him because he could influence people, because people would listen. You know, when Henry Clay talked, people listened, and that's how he became, you know, much more influential and gave that position of Speaker of the House much more power. But then after he left, apparently the position kind of weakened in relevance. And we had to wait until like around the 1890s when people like Thomas Brackett Reed came along, and then in the 1900s, a guy called Joseph Gurney Cannon, both Republicans, and these guys really, you could say, perfected the art of being Speaker and having that position produce a lot of influence and power and political power. And a lot of their of the power in their usage of the speakership came from changes done around 1880 to the committee system that was being used in the House at the time. And around that time, there was this committee on rules that was set up where the Speaker of the House became the chairman, the chair of that committee. So basically, he became the main person who dictated what rules would be used to run the legislative game. So it in effect is like a referee who's given the power to decide what rules should be followed. And then you know that a referee that can define his own rules is bound to be corrupted. You know, it's like a football referee, let's say between two countries, Brazil against Ghana or whatever, and let's say that he favors Ghana, and a player from Ghana falls right outside the box, and you know the rule is that the player has to be fouled inside the box for it to become a penalty kick, but the guy, let's say, changes the rule midway and says no, if the foul happens two feet outside the box, it's still you must be awarded a penalty kick. So if he can start changing the rules to favor the team he wants to win, then he will start modifying the rules as you go to favor his team. And that's more or less what begins to happen with the Speaker of the House the moment he becomes the chair of the Rules Committee. And when you see all of this, it becomes very clear that the Founding Fathers were not running thought experiments to kind of figure out you know, where things would be taken based on where they left us. So they didn't analyze, okay, we're leaving this open-ended, and we're saying the house can define its own rules, and then eventually this may happen or this may happen. They never went through this thought experiment. And because of that ambiguity and that lack of effort or really interest in thinking things out, we have the problems we have now. So as you can see there, the Speaker of the House, you know, becomes this this person that centralizes power. And just to emphasize that, consider the current, and I say that, but it hurts to say it, you know, the current Speaker of the House, and I have to say that in quotes, at the time of this recording, this monster from San Francisco, known as Stretch Pelosi, and as some of you may have figured out, the reason why I call her Stretch Pelosi is because I used to listen to Mark Levin a lot years ago. I don't listen to him anymore, but I used to listen to him a lot. He's a radio commentator, and he would refer to her as Stretch Pelosi because when you look at her face, it looks like she's been going to the plastic surgeon a lot, so her face looks stretched out, so that's why I call her Stretch Pelosi, and that's where her eyes bug out because her face is so stretched out. So this monster, Stretch Pelosi, has been the Speaker of the House several times already. And when you think about it, she's just this crazy woman from a left loony district in the San Francisco area. I don't know how big that district is. It must be small, and it must be full of crazy lunatic left-wing liberals. And this little speck of land out in the middle of Lala of Crazy Land out there in San Francisco, put in power, sent to Washington this crazy woman, and now this crazy woman has so much power that her decisions are affecting the lives of hundreds of millions of people, people that have never been in San Francisco and will never be in San Francisco. And why? Because the Constitution and our current political system allowed the surfacing of what I call a power clot, this thing that centralizes power in an unnatural way, and that has the ability to influence people in a negative way. A power clot is like a single person who has been given the ability to exercise power beyond the power assigned to him or her via elections. No, I didn't vote for her. Most people in America didn't vote for her, wouldn't vote for her even if their life depended on it. But this woman can still affect all these people's lives, of people who didn't elect her and who would never elect her if they had a chance. So this power clot has developed, and it's called the Speaker of the House. And when power clots develop, then they prevent the natural flow of the blood in the political process. And that's why, to me, it's not a coincidence that at the time of this recording, we've been hearing so much about blood clots and people having myocarditis and issues like that after taking the pseudo vaccines. And I say vaccines in air quotes because of the virus hysteria that has gripped the world at the time of this recording. As some of you may know, like a day or two ago, there was a football player in a Euro 2020 game that's being played in 2021. A Danish player playing against, his team was playing against Finland, and he just dropped to the floor, dropped to the ground in the middle of the game. And they had to stop the game for an hour, 45 minutes, I think. And they had to revive him. He was about to die on the pitch. And they had to do CPR and revive his heart. And when I read that, when I found out about that almost in real time, I said to myself, he must have taken the jab. He must have taken the pseudo vaccine. And initially the reports were, no, he didn't take the vaccine. But then it came out, yes, he did take the vaccine 12 days before. And that was his first football match since taking the so-called vaccine. And he almost died on the pitch, a healthy young athlete. And I don't know if he'll you know, really be able to play professionally much longer with that condition. And I heard about a lady, a 19-year-old lady in Evanston, Illinois, that also took the pseudo vaccine, and she was very happy about it. She took her second shot, and she died like 2 or 3 weeks after that. She started feeling very, very bad, very ill, and it was a slow thing over a few days, and then suddenly she took a turn for the worse, and she had to be hospitalized, and her heart was in such a bad shape, they had to give her a heart transplant, and that wasn't enough, and she passed away, a 19-year-old young black lady with her life in front of her. She was, I think, already beginning to attend university. And her life was totally destroyed and gone because of this vaccine, and she developed myocarditis because of blood clots that were as a result of this pseudo vaccine. And to me, all of this is not a coincidence. And even the virus is said to cause blood clots. The fact that we have this blood clot conversation going on recently, it is just a manifestation of the power clots that we have in our political system right now that are preventing the free flow of ideas and a healthy legislative process. So there's that power clot of the Speaker of the House. We have to get rid of that under a new system. And we also have to get rid of the committee system that we just mentioned in passing. As you may know, what happens in the House and in the Senate is that they form these committees. And the idea is, oh, there's so many bills out there. We need a way to organize things. And we can't just have everybody writing bills left and right willy-nilly. And who's going to decide what's going to be voted on? It's just going to be a nightmare. So they said to give things some order. We're going to create these committees. And these committees are going to specialize in certain things, you know, committees on, I don't know what they are. I don't know the list, and I couldn't care less. But let's say there's a committee on national defense, a committee on budget and financing, a committee on agriculture or whatever. So if somebody has the idea of a bill on agriculture, then he has to write it up and then go and try to get the committee, the agriculture committee, if there is such a thing, to take a look at the bill. And then the committee, you know, if they deign to list to look at the bill, they will read the bill and analyze it, talk about it, and then vote on it. And if inside the committee there's not enough votes for it to come out of committee, then the bill dies inside committee and it never sees the light of day. No one else sees the committee the bill except the committee. And who decides what bills, you know, are voted on in the committee? The committee chair. So then we start seeing the committee is a power clot, and within that power clot, this one nastier power clot called the chairman or chairwoman or whatever of the committee. So if you have a great idea, a great bill, but you're a Republican and the committee chair is a Democrat, your bill is almost dead before it even, you know, has the chance to live. But even if it does have a chance, you have to go kiss the chair person's buttocks. You have to kiss up to them. You have to do all these things to get the chairperson to to pay attention to you. So you create this concentration of power in this person who decides the life and death of a bill. And he was elected from a certain district. And that district voted for him, and now he's in a position where he's deciding on bills that affect the entire country. And no one put him in a position of power. No one elected him to that position, to that much power. He was there to represent his district, to offer ideas to the rest of the representatives so that everyone should democratically and in an egalitarian way vote for what is best for all. Not this system where you have this concentration of power in the committee chairs and the committees itself. So because that's where all that political back and forth starts happening. And the committee chair starts feeling powerful because he knows if a bill on agriculture is to live, it is going to be depending on my thumbs up or my thumbs down. And then if there are interest groups out there, you know, that have to do with agriculture, they know that they have to go kiss up to the chair. The chairman knows, hey, I have the power over agricultural bills. So any lobbying group that wants a certain bill passed, they can come up to the chairperson and say, hey, we're going to give you a whole buttload of money for your reelection if you pass this bill that helps us. And the chairperson knows that he has the power to make that happen. And why is, and that's where all the corruption starts, because we have a system that promotes power clots. And on top of that, we have a third layer of power clots in the party, because the committees and the chairs are decided based on who is the party in power. So the party is concerned about gaining the majority in Congress, because once they have the majority, the people in the party behind the scenes have authority over who can be in what committee and who can be the chair of what committee, even though, you know, the main influencer of that is the speaker, him or herself. It's also the party that's behind the speaker that is in behind the scenes making decisions on who they like, who they don't like. So then you start developing another level of power class, the party, the party chairman, and all these people behind the scenes that were never elected into office, who are making decisions that they were never allowed or authorized to make. So we have the Speaker of the House as a power clot. We have the committee system as a power clot. We have the committee chairs as a power clot. And we also have the parties as power clots. And we have to create a system, a constitutional system, that is anti-power clots. And I think that if we write it out correctly, we can do it in a very simple and straightforward way, so where we can lay it out that any political system or any political methodology or procedure that promotes power clots is inherently unconstitutional. And I know that sounds very ambiguous, but we can give some meat to that general idea in a very practical way, so that in future these power clots never exist. It's like giving an aspirin a blood thinner to the whole system, so that we can have our blood flowing more freely. So we want a system that does not depend on individuals, but on rules to run efficiently. And that's what the Constitution has to promote. And as some of you may know, John Adams, I think in 1780, if I'm not mistaken, he said something about wanting, I think he was, he put it in the Massachusetts Constitution, or if I'm not mistaken, please forgive me if I'm wrong on that. But at some point, someone, possibly John Adams, said that he wanted a government of laws, not of men. And that's what we aim for, a system where we don't depend on men, on caudillos, on dictators, on ingratiating, with dictators and other powerful people to get things done, where it's not men who have power, but the laws. And that's what we want, a legislative system that's not controlled by a speaker, not controlled by a committee chair, not controlled by a committee per se, or by a party chairman behind the scenes, but a system that can run efficiently based on just a very clear set of rules. And we can do that. And also, as you know, there was this man called Adam Smith, a Scottish economist and philosopher from the 18th century. And he wrote this very famous book called The Wealth of Nations that, if I'm not mistaken, came out, interestingly enough, in 1776, the year America was born, you could say. And in that book, and also another book he wrote a few years earlier in 1759 called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, he wrote about the invisible hand. I might not be explaining it the best way possible, but in a very general sense, the invisible hand is this idea that you can have this big economy where people are making millions of transactions day and night, trading goods and services back and forth, and it's all happening without a central authority dictating what must be sold, what must be bought. You know, unlike, you know, in the old Soviet Union or in hellholes like Venezuela and Cuba or North Korea, where everything is centralized and there's this authority that decides how much rice is going to be sold and how much, you know, wheat is going to be produced, and it's all very controlled. And we all know that those economies that run in that centralized authoritarian way just collapse. The Invisible Hand spoke of how you can have a system where you have all these transactions happening, and it all just seems to flow naturally. You know, enough pizzas are made to feed all the people who want to eat pizzas, and enough pizzerias are started to make all the pizzas that all the pizza-loving people want to eat. And no one is, there's no dictate from government saying, thou shalt open 18 pizzerias this year in such and such city. It just happens, and it dynamically happens. And we have lived in this country in the most capitalist nation in human history, and we've seen the enormous success of having this relatively free capitalist system until now, and it's an evidence that the hand, that invisible hand that that Adam Smith spoke about, it is real. And what I'm trying to say with this is that we can trust that we can have a system with very diverse, very complex factors working in harmony without a centralized manual control of an individual or a committee. And just think about the stock market, even though I don't agree with the stock market per se, and that will be a subject of another audio clip. To me, the stock market is one of the other cancers that we have in American society, and it's very anti-capitalist, despite the fact that it looks capitalistic to most people. But that aside, if you just think about the stock market on the floor, at least in the old days, you'd have all these people buying and selling and shouting and all this mayhem going on the stock floor. And despite all that mayhem, the transactions would happen. And the stock prices rise and fall, you know, dynamically without a centralized entity controlling everything. So it is possible to have a system where things flow with fluidity and great liberty without power clots, where you don't depend on an individual or a committee to run things and cause all these blood clottings and aneurysms that we've had in our political system. And so we'll continue talking about how that system will look. So we've kind of laid out the foundation that we want a system without power clots. We want a system with no Speaker of the House. There's going to be a version of that, but it's going to be different. And we'll share all the details on how that legislative process would work in future audio clips. Thank you very much.